As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, blenders, and welcome to episode number 104 of Real Blend, a podcast that hopes that Christopher Nolan's Tenet trailer wins Best Picture at the Oscars on Sunday. We are going to do our final predictions for the Oscars.
I'd be okay with that.
That'd be okay, right? I'm fine with that. And we're also going to be giving you Birds of Prey reviews. We're also thrilled to be joined on this week's episode by Birds of Prey director Kathy Yan, who sat down with us at the London Junket. But I'm going to very quickly introduce the guys for a couple different reasons. One, we got a lot of show to get to this week, but also two, Jake is having an audio issue. Jake, how are you doing?
Apparently this week the show is sponsored by the new Saw movie because the new trailer came out today, because there's just a blasting Saw sound that is coming from above my apartment. So the recording of this particular Real Blend episode is going to take about 18 hours because we have to keep stopping and starting every time we hear, and I'm too afraid to go ask real men of that are performing manual labor to stop doing manual labor so me and my friends can talk about movies.
Excuse me, sir, do you not know that the Oscars are this Sunday and we have to discuss each category in
detail? I am wearing makeup, but I'd like to ask you a favor. Could you please stop with your power tools?
I understand you're on a deadline, but we have to record a podcast. Thank you.
My friends and I would like to talk about film.
All right, so I mean, it's going to be a lot more this week of me and the other guest, Kevin McCarthy of host, Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev.
Hey, yeah, my mom just moved in above Jake, so she's just messing around with the new tech equipment up there, so... That's awesome. Thanks, Mom.
Good for her. We're going to start off with our weekly poll, which ties into the Birds of Prey. We ran a question for everybody that says, Margot Robbie's best role. And I put three choices and then an other. Kevin, I'm going to have you guess. Between Tonya Harding, Harley Quinn, Sharon Tate, or other, what do you think won?
I'm going to say Harley Quinn. No question.
I would have thought that also. Tonya Harding won.
Really?
39% of the people went with Tonya Harding over Harley Quinn. And I don't understand that necessarily, because I think her signature role for sure is playing Harley in both Suicide Squad and now Birds of Prey.
It just sounds like people are huge Sebastian fans of that movie. You know, maybe it's one of those things, you know, just one of those things.
Yeah. And I mean, don't get me wrong. She's Skate in the role, but
I feel like people...
By the way, I do want to clarify for our, because I think this is amazing. Jake has to mute his microphone every time they drill.
Yes.
So if Jake wants to come in and say something, he has to press a button in order to be able to talk. This is actually really fun for me to experience watching this.
It's very hard for him to get in some words of prey in this week's episode.
Yeah, that's really good.
Unfortunately.
I quit.
Who else put in, there were, who for people who said other, Gabe, do you remember what they said?
Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah, Wolf of Wall Street. I saw some of that.
But I feel like people are confusing performance for role. Because I think you could say like her best performance is I, Tonya, but I mean, how can you say, I mean, even though I hated Suicide Squad, her best role is Harley Quinn.
God,
you know,
damn it.
that poll answer actually kind of is a bombshell a little bit, right? I mean, like, you think about it, I thought it was going to be Harley Quinn. I was actually surprised.
I'm going to say one role that someone, I know someone pointed this out too, and I totally forgot that she was even in it. She's in Legend of Tarzan, apparently.
Yeah,
she's
I interviewed Jane. Her for that one.
Did
yeah.
you really? Yeah. yeah. I had no clue that she was even in that film. So anyway.
I don't think she did either. That movie was not great. I will say, I thought she is always great though. Yes. No matter what she's in, even in Tarzan, she was still awesome. But that movie was just, oof.
And she's a terrific interview. And if you haven't yet gone to our YouTube channels, you can go to Cinema Blend's YouTube channel. You can go to Jake's Takes. You can watch our interview with the cast of Birds of Prey, including Miss Margot Robbie, and including the director, Kathy Yan, who, as I pointed out at the beginning of this week's episode, is our guest on Real Blend for this week. We were able to get 30 minutes with Kathy talking about her approach to the DC Universe, working with Chad Stahelski to increase the action in her film, working with Margot, who has ownership over the role of Harley, and a lot of other really cool topics. So why don't I stop telling you what she's going to discuss and throw it right to Kathy Yan, the director of Birds of Prey. I'm curious, what were some of the first sort of questions and conversations that you started having with Margot about Harley as you tried to sort of figure out how you were going to approach the character?
Totally. It's interesting because obviously she's played Harley before. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's certainly like a respect there of like, well, you've already played Harley, so, you know, what do you think? But I think she actually loved the challenge of kind of getting to not completely reinvent Harley, but certainly see her in a different light, mm-hmm. a light that doesn't involve being the Joker's girlfriend.
Right.
Right? And that's the whole beginning of the movie. And I think we just had a lot of fun in crafting a Harley that feels really relatable. And I think she's very much like infused with a lot of Margot, right? Like the sort of the humor that she has, her fondness for food, for animals, and that's all Margot too. And so that was really, really fun. And I think we both really wanted to make sure that she felt real and human and vulnerable in this movie, in a way that you haven't really seen her before.
It's a terrific breakup movie. And I'm not sure that the subtitle made sense to people or does. Like, they're like, that's a long title. Why are they doing that? But it's so integral to the story that you're trying to tell. Like, it really is a good breakup movie with her trying to figure out how to take those next steps forward.
Yeah, totally. It's a very existential movie in that way.
You also kick it off in a very fun way, which was your animated sequence. Not anything I was expecting at all. And mm-hmm. I kind of realize now after the fact, is it an homage to the Looney Tunes type things that Harley loves watching?
Yeah, definitely. A little bit of that. I mean, I think we sort of try to pay homage to the classic comics as well. Mm-hmm. And she's such a... She has such a childlike wonder on things, you know. It totally makes sense to me that she'd be eating cereal and watching Looney Tunes. and so, I it was definitely a play on that, all of it, yeah.
Right, but in those bits, too, I thought I saw some traces of Suicide Squad footage. I was wondering, did you use some existing footage from that movie, or did you go back and shoot that stuff yourself?
We did. We actually did use some of the Suicide Squad
Very
footage,
cool.
yeah.
And was there a way, how did you sort of match it up to the color palettes and things that you're going for? Did it match pretty well?
I think we tweaked it a little bit to fit in our world, but the whole point was that it should feel like, you know, a memory, and
right.
that was what everything that she was thinking through, the flashes of that she was, you know, that was what she was, that was what was impacting her as she's like driving to, you know, do her thing.
Right.
So I really like that. I like that little flourish, and I think it helped remind people what the significance of Ace Chemicals is.
Did you ever think you were going to get Jared to fill in any of those scenes?
I don't think we need Jared.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just able to exist on its own.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like she doesn't need a Joker.
I am fascinated by filmmakers who get to put their stamp and design on Gotham.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been so many over the years now, and even just recently now, with Todd Phillips being able to do it, with people watching the television show that was inspired by it, but going back to obviously Nolan and mm-hmm. Tim Burton. So what were some of the choices you made aesthetically to how you wanted to sort of present? To me, it's such an iconic location that we get to visit every couple of years.
Oh, Oh, absolutely. I love Gotham. Yeah. I grew up watching the Batman movies and just loving Gotham. And I think there's so many different interpretations of it. I mean, it's been very campy before, like the Joel Schumacher and the Tim Burton ones are quite, you know, exaggerated and campy. And then you've got the Christopher Nolan stuff that's very dark and austere and, you know, a little more serious. And, you know, and I think I wanted to sort of try to do something kind of in the middle of that. And on top of that, do something that felt specific to Harley and her perspective. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we see a lot of, and Gotham is not a lovely place, right? It's, I mean, that's the whole point. It's like you have all these amazing villains that run Gotham, and it's not, it doesn't work well. It's not a perfect society or you know, by any means. Right. And that's what's so fun about it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my references, like sort of spiritually, we're actually just like New York in the 70s and 80s. I'm a New Yorker. I've lived in downtown New York for a long, long time. So part of me was really like, you know, I love that, like just a personal connection to it. But the way that New York was back then, I think, or at least I guess the idea of it, the nostalgic version of it is that, like, yeah, it was completely broken, like crime infested, you know, like corruption, all of that. But at the same time, like, there's such magic and there's such crazy characters and crazy stories and amazing art, and all of that thrived alongside it. And that was sort of the Gotham that I wanted to create, where, like, yeah, it's not, you know, it doesn't always work. It's pretty dirty, it's pretty grimy, it's gritty, it's on the streets, you know. The rule of law has not, you know, completely worked.
Right.
But at the same time, like, people are still living their lives and they're having fun and there's still hope, and, you know, they just kind of like just keep trudging on.
Right.
and the spirit of that.
Well, and Harley doesn't look out of place in your vision of
yes.
it. There's a great moment where she's running through a street fair
yeah.
and she stops to see the bag that she might actually, you know, mm-hmm. stop and buy if she were not being chased by totally. Killers.
Totally. I mean, it's funny because I was like, well, how can we camouflage Harley? And then we found the one place that she could actually sort of be camouflaged.
Right. Very true. You put up in a really fun sequence motives for why all these people are furious with Harley, mm-hmm. why they would want her dead. And you got a lot of fun with that.
Mm-hmm.
I did notice when Black Mask came up,
mm-hmm.
there were a lot of them that went past.
Yes.
So fast that you can't even read any
yep.
of them. Do you remember any of the fun ones that you put in that might have gone past?
Oh, yeah. We had so much fun throwing out, like, different ones. I think, you know, it was always grounded in character, like what he would be pissed off about,
right.
what she would do. And it's just so fun and cheeky.
They
yeah.
have such a long history together.
Exactly. And it obviously shows exactly why, you know, he is our main antagonist.
Right. Oh, let's talk about Ewan for a little bit. Mm-hmm. I talked to Christina about this too, of how much of it was on the page, all these colorful flourishes that he brings. Mm-hmm. But working with him, she said, one thing she said that was really interesting was that he made lines that you guys never actually thought would be funny,
mm-hmm.
Really funny, just mm-hmm. the way that he approached them. So talk to me about how he created that character, because he's, to me, one of the most memorable DC villains that
oh.
I think we've seen on screen.
Thank you. Well, he also added lines. You know, I like to work in a way where it's a real collaboration between the actors, and, you know, we'll have fun on set, and it's very open, and you know, you're completely, and what was great was, like, Christina was not precious with the script either, and quite supportive of that. And so we were just, like, you know, throwing ideas around, and, you know, he'll come up with a line, and I'm like, I love that line, let's, like, add it in or whatnot. So that happened a lot, and he's just wickedly funny. But I also think because he really understood the character, he really got it, and he understood, you know, the background of the character, the chip on the shoulder, the desire for power, the desire for control, but also the fact that he couldn't really even control his own emotions. He couldn't control his situation particularly well, and that made him extremely angry all the time and resentful. And you know, that was why he wanted to do what he was doing.
Right.
And also he was like a man so in love with himself that he often couldn't, like, see past that. So, like, with all of those ingredients, I thought it was a really interesting and meaty character. And then we always knew that, like, I like the idea that he was not, you know, this, like, big macho dude that, like, was just the most obvious or stereotypical version of, like, a villain in a female-driven movie.
Sure.
And obviously he is this party boy, and, you know, he likes his things. He's a collector. He's a collector of masks and artifacts and of people and humans and of women. And so all of that, and just creating the world of Black Mass and the slickness of it. And, you know, we wanted to kind of make him like this showboat, and someone that was like cool and interesting, and so like there was no one else that could play that character in my mind, sure. You know, and Ewan just brings such charisma and charm to it, and I always said that I wanted to like Roman Sionis.
Well, and you do, and that's such a dangerous line to walk,
mm-hmm.
and with almost all of the DC villains, mm-hmm. I almost feel like DC does villains in a way.
Oh, I love the DC villains for sure.
They're so relatable mm-hmm. on so many levels. It's almost to the point they overshadow the heroes more.
Yeah,
often
they're
than
very
that.
Sympathetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're very sympathetic. They're nuanced. They're interesting. And, you know, with Roman, it's like, oh, God, you're laughing with him. Yeah, you're laughing with him. You might think he's even charming. And,
right.
You know, when you have Ewan there, it makes it even easier.
That helps a whole lot. Yes, it does. Does it surprise you now that the DC villains like Joker are getting their own standalone films?
Not at all, because I think I totally agree with you. They've always been wonderful and really, really amazing characters. And, you know, it's no surprise, I think.
I think I spotted a moment where Jai Courtney was on a wanted poster.
Yeah.
Is that Jai Courtney there? It went by so quickly.
Yeah.
Was that just an idea to connect to the existing world? A lot of people look for these threads, you know, that pull all these movies together.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a cheeky little nod.
Gotcha. That was funny. I just wanted to confirm that was definitely there. The scene that stands out to me also, too, which is shown in the trailers, is the Marilyn Monroe sequence. Mm-hmm. It felt like we were able in that moment to go into Harley's mind, you know, for one of the few times. Here's what she's seeing things through, that Harley vision that's important to the comics. Mm-hmm. Is that what came for the construction of that scene? Is you wanted to sort of take us through her vision of, like, in a horrible situation that she's in, this is how she would envision herself?
Yeah, totally. I think that's exactly the intent of it. And it was amazingly fun to shoot and to try to figure out, like, what's the Harley spin on, you know, the classic Marilyn Monroe sequence, and we pay homage in all these interesting ways, and worked with an amazing dance choreographer, Ryan Heffington. He is just a genius, and it was so fun, and, you know, Margot's in it, and Ewan's in it, and Chris is in it, and there's actually an extended version of the dance sequence that hopefully will be shared with the world as well. And I used to be a dancer, so it was especially fun for me, especially fun to design, to shoot, to, you know, kind of recreate the diamonds in our own way.
Right.
And, you know, I think at one point I was like, it's kind of like a Lynchian razzmatazz.
Now, so it didn't exist in the script? Like, did you come and say, like, we're putting a dance sequence in the middle of this?
Oh, no. The script, it did exist in the script. And okay. It was pretty much like a huge selling point of the script for me. I desperately wanted to do that. And it was something that, like, you know, I kind of focused on in my pitch, too, because I think it says a lot. I think it says a lot in a really fun, cheeky way. I think, you know, even the use of the diamond and the symbolism of that and, you know, this idea that, like, you know, that you want, like, a man has to spend, you know, what is it, 2-3 months of his salary on a diamond because they last forever.
Right.
And the symbolism of that and, like, belong, you know, like that women can be bought in that way, bought right. and sold in that way. So there was just a lot in there. That I really liked. I loved the line, you know, like, that, like, I thought a man was meant to get the girl a diamond. I mean, all of it was just very, very spot on, I think, and very, very layered. Right. And then we try to, like, expand on that symbolism of, like, putting her in a pantsuit instead of a dress, you know, things like that.
Interesting. Oh, these are things you'll pick up on multiple views.
Yeah, and, like, even the Black Mask. Actually, the whole sequence we shot in the Black Mask Club because it's meant to be, you know, a fantasy taken from that scene, from
right.
that location.
Right.
And so, you know, and all the men are wearing the Black mask
right,
and
right.
we had pink machine guns.
Right. That's so great. To the point, in the Black Mask Club, Canary sings her song.
Mm-hmm.
It's a man's world, mm-hmm. you know, but it would mean nothing without a woman or a girl. Commentary on the comic book genre?
There's so many ways you can interpret that, I guess, but I just like the idea, since we were already doing it with Marilyn, that there would be other moments in the movie where we could just take something that felt very old and traditional and flip it
mm-hmm.
and give it a different, you know, kind of perspective on it.
Oh, that's how I read it. So I hope other people read it that way too. Let's keep going through your music because your song choices are phenomenal.
Oh, thank you.
And add an extra layer of energy that I think a lot of these movies lack sometimes. You know, there are lulls when you have to get exposition, but you figure out ways to cut us through the story on the back of a high energy song. So just talk about your approach with that.
Yeah, I really love music. When we first sat down and we did some camera tests and costume tests, and ultimately there was like a little reel that came out and was available online. But I had created playlists for all of our different characters. Mm-hmm. That was really important to me, and it was such an evocative way of, I think, helping the actors understand their characters.
Is this during the screenwriting process?
This was a little later than that, but this was like early prep when we would do camera tests. So okay. Normally you just like do a kind of traditional camera test and you're just making sure that the lighting and like the type of camera and the costumes, it's always a costumes and hair test as well.
Right.
But I was actually very much inspired by what Todd Phillips did with the Joker camera test, where it was like very interesting. And I don't know if you saw that, but
is that the first Instagram post that they put out?
It was, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Was your camera test that first trailer that you guys put out?
Yeah, if you call it a trailer, it was the. Yes, it was very, very early on.
Yeah.
It was the Moderat song.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a trailer. That was just clips
first
from
look.
Our camera test.
Sure.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And the Moderat song was actually a song that I had chosen for Huntress.
Okay.
Originally. But yeah, I kind of created these playlists for everybody. And that's just, I always do that for all of my characters. I think it's really fun. And so music was always a huge element of this movie for me.
I'll tell you what we have to do when that comes out. Freeze frame it because the montage goes by really fast.
It
right?
does.
There's
yes.
us. Wait,
yes.
there's Ewan. I think yes. I see Ewan.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
Canary.
I think I see him. Yeah,
exactly. Let's transition to the physicality of Margot. You and I talked in the earlier bit about putting her in roller skates. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about Harley, I find, is that she's a person. You know, she's a normal person. Mm-hmm. And so when you approach stunts, it's not like you can fall back on her superpowers.
Right.
How much do you put...
Which
how
I love.
Much, yeah, how much thought do you put into choreographing? You have some amazing fight sequences, and especially the roller skates in the back of the car. Mm-hmm. How much do you stop to think about, like, I can only put her through so much, because she's a person?
Right, yeah, absolutely. I think it was always this interesting line that we were towing with the whole movie. Like, it's a heightened world, but
right.
there was also something kind of realistic about it, mm-hmm. and I always tried to ground everything in a related human, emotion mm-hmm. or something. And so, like with Harley, she's a great gymnast. She obviously knows her way around a mallet and a bat. And that was kind of what we focused on. It's like, okay, so what is she actually able to do? Is her flexibility an asset?
Right.
And also talking, like, considering what women are better at in some ways, or how can a woman, like, actually fight men,
right.
And it's not necessarily strength, but maybe it's flexibility.
Right.
Maybe it's the fact that they are smaller and shorter, and they can kind of get around things, or maybe they're faster, or maybe they're more creative, or I think Harley also has a superpower called her brain,
yeah.
and she's very like able to psychoanalyze people, and she's quite smart, and she's like ahead of you, and so that was all part of it too. That was by design. That was something that we considered very, very much for all of the characters and for all the action sequences.
How's the conversation when you say we're gonna have her inhale a lot of cocaine?
Well, we just lean into that R rating.
Yeah, I chalked up as something I never thought I would ever see.
I know, but it just feels right.
It really does. There's a great also prison fight sequence where a lot of convicts are released at one time that are in Gotham's prison cells. I was curious, did you ever think about putting like a famous, recognizable DC villain in there at any point?
Oh, no, but that would have been a smart idea.
Let's go back.
Yeah.
Reshoots. There were reports that Chad Stahelski came on board and helped with the action. I'm curious what your collaboration was like with him, because came out of this raving about the action sequences and think that they turned out really great. So how did you two work together?
Yeah, so we had been working with 8711 from the get-go, and that was the style that I wanted for the movie. It just felt right. It was that like mix of practical but also heightened,
mm-hmm.
Like where it felt really real, but like they were also kind of having fun with it. And I liked the way it was shot. Mm-hmm. I liked that it wasn't too cutty, like all of his work beforehand. And so, during production, I was working mostly with Jonathan Eusebio on that, and he's just a delight and choreographed some really amazing fight sequences. And then when it came to reshoots, it was like, let's add more action. Like, let's just make, you know, let's lean into this. It's working, and let's make it even more cool and badass. And at that time, I think Chad was just available. So it was like, cool. We get the best of the best.
Isn't that lucky?
Yeah, exactly. So, and because obviously he runs 8711, so it just kind of became this natural fit. And he really, I think, he just... It was really interesting to see how he shoots things too, you know, and working with him in that way, and just kind of having fun, and he's awesome. Like, he's a real, I think it was interesting because he's a real director, and so I think we actually kind of learned a lot from each other because he's quite a cinephile, and so we would talk about just like, you know, completely like
geeky references.
Yeah, geek out about like Tarkovsky and, you know, and whatnot, and we'll talk about that, and then he'll be like, well, here's this trick to do this for, you know, like, you can't, you know, like, if you're shooting a punch, you want to shoot, you know, like, little tricks of the trade that he just knows better than anyone, and like the rigging involved and whatnot. So I like learned so much from him and his team, in terms of just like like how to shoot stunts, how the practicality of like, you know, all the equipment and stuff that I'd never seen before, I'd never worked with before.
He joined our show to talk about John Wick 3, mm-hmm. and he talked about the dog fight sequences where they stick dogs on people.
Yeah.
And he broke down how many weeks it takes to get the dogs used to your stunt performers, that they have to spend time around each other, you know, so that when you'd go for these, and you never think about the amount of work that goes into the, you're watching a sequence and you're like, man, this looks amazing, but it's months of preparation. And that brings me to your funhouse scene, which is fantastic, you know, and I think the reason to go is because it's unlike anything that you've ever seen, but it's such a DC Harley, you know, fight sequence.
Yeah.
But halfway through it, I'm watching it, I'm thinking, this must have been crazy to prep, just to choreograph and to pull off all of that. Was it the most daunting thing that you guys worked on in the movie?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I had doubts about it. Everyone had doubts about it. Thankfully, I stuck to my guns about that one. Yeah, that was actually an idea I had very, very early on, where there was always going to be that moment when all the women came together and they fought for the final time and to protect Cass. And I thought, like, let's shoot it in a way where it feels celebratory and fluid, and like they're finally, like, the kinks have been worked out and they're working as a team.
Right.
And, you know, it's not like stop and go, but it just kind of has this like momentum to it. And then it was such an interesting, like, interdepartmental challenge, the fun house, because it was a lot of production design, and KK Barrett is an absolute genius, and so he creates these like little models of things, and actually in the original script it wasn't a fun house, it was something else, and then
still a carnival, or
there are carnival elements to it, but it was not a fun house.
Okay.
Partially probably because Christina was like, I'm not going to write that because that sounds crazy, and I don't want to give that challenge to Kathy, you know? But then, of course, like, you know, of course, I was like, let's do a fun house.
Yeah.
And that was really, really just so fun to create in the world of that. And, you know, KK would create these, like, tiny little models. And so you would actually see the whole thing and what it looked like and the layers and textures of it and, you know, and all the female figures and the booby trap and all of that. It was just so fun to infuse it all and figuring out, like, you know, we wanted every woman to sort of have her
moments,
I guess, or her like little corner.
Mary Elizabeth kills a guy on a slide.
Exactly. That was my fantasy. I can't believe that actually happened. That's insane. And so we just had so much fun with it, and then of course it was like production design, it was special effects, so that like the actual physics behind it, and having to work with a slide company, and having to work with, like, you know, physicists to figure out, like, you know, how do we do these moving floors, how do we move the carousel, what's like the number of people, like the weight of the carousel. I think the first carousel we had just like buckled under the weight of everyone, and all of that had to be tested and then created, and then only then could the stunt team actually come in and choreograph it. And on top of that, then the women had to learn it, of course. And on top of that, for the carousel itself, that was just a crazy task that I regretted at the time imposing on everyone, but now I'm very happy about and, you know, thankful for. But like, it was just, it was the idea of having all of our women fighting So it was like five women, like the four women plus Cassandra Cain, plus like 5 to 10, stunt players as well.
Sure.
Plus our camera guy in the on the movie rig, plus all of sound, plus me, plus everyone. And we all had to move in tandem to get out of each other's way.
Oh my gosh.
So that was
incredible.
So we had to watch. I worked with JoJo and the team on choreographing the fight sequence and what it would look like. And I loved the moment where it was like, pass the Cass, you know, and they just, you know, we follow Cass and she just gets like bumped around and, you know, things come in and out of frame and, you know, we use foreground and background. And then once we saw that just many, many, many times, Maddie Libatique, our amazing DP, would come on the carousel and then kind of start to figure out how to dance with it, you know, with the camera. And so it became this like kind of epic dance. And because these shots were really long, I mean, there were shots that were like 30 seconds long,
right.
And no one can mess it up. And so there was a lot of that. And the whole time Margo's on freaking roller skates.
Right.
You know, and we had like the bouncy hands. There's just so much going on. And I remember every take that we did too, we actually had to make sure that we started and stopped at the same place because all the backgrounds were changed.
Oh my gosh.
But actually there was no better way to shoot it, because if you try to cut up a scene like that, right, it's actually incredibly confusing. You don't know who to look at, the background is changing, you know. So it actually ended up being almost the only way to shoot it.
Right.
But of course it was way more challenging that way, because you had to get a perfect take,
right,
in order to move on. You couldn't settle.
Right.
Yeah. Very true. So please, everybody, when you see the movie, pay attention to that sequence. There's a lot of time and effort went into it by a lot of passionate people. So
yeah, and a lot of the cast hated my guts for a while.
Well, we're going to run out of time, so I just want to thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, obviously, to Kathy for joining us and talking Birds of Prey, and also to our good friends at Warner Brothers for hooking us up with that interview. We love the fact that when we get to do a junket, that they take the time to carve out some space for the directors to join us, or even some of the cast members to join us on this show. We hope to continue to do a lot of that in the coming weeks. All right, we got a lot to get to this week in terms of Sunday being the Academy Awards. And what we're going to do is go through each category right now, read off the nominees, and give you our picks for who we think is going to win. Now, Gabe is going to keep track of this entire thing. And we worked up a fun bet. Last year, we did burgers. Obviously, we're big fans of burgers on this show. Everybody has their brand of choice, as you know, essentially, if you've listened to the show or followed us on social media. This year, Kev, we're going to do something a little different. Why don't you explain to the blenders out there,
yeah,
what the winner of the contest is going to get to do?
I'm already so excited about this, unless I lose. But what we're going to do is the winner of the Oscar ballot in regards to getting the most nominees and most predictions right is going to have to choose two horrendously bad films for the two losers to watch. And so we were riffing back and forth before the show started about possible horrendous films to show people. And one of the movies, which I'm kind of hoping Jake doesn't win, because Jake's never seen a movie called Irreversible, and that's the only movie in my lifetime that I've ever turned off midway through, because I just couldn't handle how brutal it was after that fire extinguisher sequence. But so I would love to hear Jake's reaction to that film, because it is just a horrifyingly brutal experience. But that's what will happen. Yeah,
my choice is probably going to be one of the Human Centipede movies. And not even Kevin said he had to sort of dry heave during the first one.
Oh, yeah.
The first one is pretty tame compared to its sequels. So we may get it, because by that second or third one, I forget which one it is, they end up in a prison and it's a lot of prisoners tied together.
Prison yard. The first time I ever saw Human Centipede, I was telling you guys, I was living in a townhouse with roommates, and I think I got a link for it because I was like reviewing the film on the radio at that time, and I had to get up and physically dry heave into my sink in my bathroom about three times. I remember three times specifically getting up and doing that, because it was so nasty. But yeah, so that's what's going to happen. So whoever wins and gets the most predictions right gets to choose the two films that the two losers have to watch. And then those two losers have the ability. They are allowed to live tweet it if they want to, but that is the punishment for losing.
At the very least, we will come back to the show and give official reviews of the horrible movie that we had to watch. And it's kind of an honor system, but I think we all trusted each other enough that if we're assigned a horrific movie, that person will have to sit all the way through it and come back with a review.
If Jake watches Irreversible, though, I want a full live stream of his face. Like, okay. I want FaceTime during that movie. Oh, man. I don't wish that movie on anybody. It's so horrifying.
You're actually kind of making me curious to watch it at this point.
No, yeah. Trust me. Sean, I'm not overselling how disgusting this film is.
No, you're not. And only, like, I had forgotten the fire extinguisher moment.
Is it a horror movie?
It's hard to describe.
Yeah.
No, it's not a horror movie.
It's like a psychological, I never finished it. I actually don't know what it's about.
It's like a rom-com. Yeah, Julia Roberts is in it.
It's a sequel to Love Actually.
Yeah. We're going to start with visual effects, and I'll read you guys. Okay, so here are the nominees for visual effects at the Academy Awards, which will be given out this Sunday. Avengers Endgame, Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker, 1917, The Irishman and The Lion King. I'll go first. I'm going to say the visual effects are going to go to The Lion King.
Jake?
I'm going to say 1917.
I'm going to say 1917 as well, only because that film is such a technical achievement that I feel like that's what people are thinking about when they think about visual effects. I think Lion King, it's an interesting one. I'm going to go 1917.
Okay, let's jump to costume design. You have The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Joker, Little Women, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah. I'm sorry. The sound of the drill, it's like this recurring comedic bit, and it sounds like someone's
I'm
farting.
Glad that you guys think this is funny, because I actually have to be in this freaking apartment while it's happening.
Well, Jake, and the best thing about the situation is you actually could pass gas loudly, and we would not know. We would just think it was a drill. Hashtag bathroom blend. All right. Repeat the real quick on the costume design.
Costume design, and Kevin, you're going to pick first. Irishman, okay. Jojo Rabbit, Joker, Little Women, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Little Women.
Jakey.
Little Women.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. And for clarification, these are not what we want to win, but what we think will win. Yeah,
so far, we haven't all really, well, you guys have agreed on your two picks so far, but Gabe has also said he has a tiebreaker in place.
Oh, if Kevin and I both tie and win, we should be able to pick two movies that you have to watch.
Well, that's really not fair. That's
you know what?
Not fair.
I know Gabe does have a plan if we tie.
We're only two categories in. I'm sure Kevin and I are going to disagree at some point.
Well, Gabe did say in a very harsh manner before the show started, whoever doesn't win is the loser. Like, he wanted to emphasize, if you don't win, you're immediate.
Did he say the loser or a loser?
He said a loser.
No, he said Zeher.
And he moved his hand around as he did it. Lahu.
Zeher.
He does a fancy rap sign.
All right, original song. Wait, no. Sorry, Makeup and Hair. Makeup and Hair, Bombshell, Joker, Judy, Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, and 1917. Jake.
I'm going to go with Bombshell.
Kevin.
Bombshell.
Oof. I'm going to go Joker.
Woo! But then Joaquin Phoenix would have to get that award because he did his own makeup.
Joaquin. Yes, and we discussed that on our show.
I know, we asked him that.
Oh my God, Maleficent, Mistress of Evil is an Oscar nominee. Process.
Suicide Squad's an Oscar winner.
Yeah, yeah.
It has an Oscar? It had a
win? Doesn't Suicide Squad win an Oscar?
Yeah.
For what?
One of the sound categories.
Really? Good Lord.
It's like that famous John Stewart line. Suicide Squad, 1. Gangs in New York, 0.
All right. Original song. I'll give you the movies because I don't have the songs here. Toy Story 4, Rocket Man, Breakthrough, Frozen 2, and Harriet. I'm going Rocket Man.
I'm also going Rocket Man.
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I'm going to go with... I mean, I feel like Rocket Man is the easy choice, right? Because you want Elton John and Bernie to get on stage. And didn't they win the Globe?
They did win the Globe, yes.
All right. Well, Also, when we're giving these, maybe if we can insert some reasoning, I think there's some interesting aspects to it, because once we get to the larger categories, especially Best Picture.
That's what
I feel like we've got 78 categories, so I'll save my reasoning for the big ones.
But I think that's interesting. That's my reasoning for picking that is because they won the Globe.
But with Harriet, Cynthia Erivo, she didn't write that song. She just performed it.
She did.
Oh, she did write it also.
She did, yeah. If that song wins, I think Cynthia Erivo is an Oscar winner.
And she gets an EGOT. I think Oscar is the last one she needs.
Wait, really?
I'm pretty sure I read that today.
Yes. What does she have an Emmy for? I know Broadway, Tony, makes sense. Grammy, I can see that for singing. And I just don't know what she would have an Emmy for unless there was some kind of... I don't know.
Sidebar. She is so good in The Outsider right now. If you're not watching The Outsider, you're missing out.
She won, a Daytime Emmy Award in 2017 for Outstanding Musical Performance in a Daytime Program.
Does Daytime Emmy count as an EGOT?
I think so. Sure.
Okay.
You guys know I'm only 3 awards away from an EGOT.
Yes, we know that.
I just have the GOT.
Yes, and hair. Don't forget hair. Yeah. Don't ever take hair away from yourself, my friend.
Well, if you put an H on the end, then I would have an EGOT.
All right, here's where things get really exciting. Original score: Joker, Little Women, Marriage Story, 1917, and Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker.
Joker.
I think, Joker. I'd love to see them put another Oscar in John Williams' hands, but I don't think it's going to be for Rise of Skywalker.
That's where I am torn, because I want to side with you guys and pick Hildur for Joker. And she's won just about everything up until this point.
Yeah. I'm going to be your friend here.
Yes.
Hildur's going to win it.
Follow your brain, not your heart.
I will say Joker. Yes.
I feel like you were voting from your heart.
Yeah, that category's over. And what's interesting about that, did you guys see they announced that they're going to go on tour with the Joker score?
That's awesome. Yes, they're going to perform the show or screen the movie and have a symphony accompaniment with
that. That's awesome. I saw someone put a joke the other day about like people are going to be dancing down the steps of the aisles of the at the concert.
Oh, that'd be funny. I think she's going to win. Okay, production design. The Irishman. Jojo Rabbit. 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Parasite. That's a tough one.
Well, Hollywood deserves it, but we all know 17's going to get it.
I'm going to say Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood wins.
But remember, 1917, again, I don't want to sway votes.
Yeah, but the production design of Hollywood, I think, is immiscible.
I agree, but remember the featurettes of 1917 and those... vast landscapes, digging the trenches. I feel like that's going to be taken into consideration.
I'm going Hollywood.
All right.
Production design. Let's see.
See, now Kevin and I are diverting in the woods, baby.
I don't know why I'm helping you guys. What am I doing?
But that's okay. You want us to watch quality cinema. I'm going to say Hollywood in production design.
Hot damn.
Yeah. And I want to let everybody know this is throwing me off because we have show notes open here and, Gabe only put the acronym for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And it's so, every time I come on it looks like the Van Halen album, OU812. And I just want to, say that. It's OUATIH. And it trips me up every single time.
I've had that same reaction, like when the film was coming out on Twitter, people would like do that. And I would be like, what the heck are they talking about? Like, Brad Pitt was in what? I have no idea what that meant. It's a weird acronym. It really is.
Today, I saw someone do the acronym for Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
What is the acronym for that?
I mean, it's off the top of my head. I don't know. It's really long and stupid. I mean, that's the title. The title makes no sense. However, when I got to and saw that movie, it's a breakup movie. Kevin, you'll see. Kevin's going to see it in a little bit. Wait.
Well, the trailers tell you that.
Yeah. Gabe, were we supposed to review that movie or are we doing it later? We were supposed to review it earlier. Later. We're going to do it later.
Later in the show. Movies of the week. Yep.
Anyhow, sound mixing. All right, here we go. Sound mixing goes to Ad Astra, Ford v Ferrari, Joker, 1917, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I am going to give that to 1917.
Same.
Ford versus Ferrari deserves that, but 17's going to take it.
It really does deserve it. The sound in Ford Ferrari is incredible. Yeah. Let's go right to sound editing then. Essentially, you're looking at the same films for the most part, Ford v. Ferrari, Joker, 1917, Hollywood, and Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. Sound editing.
1917.
I will say 1917 also. All right. Now, this is going to get really interesting. We're shifting to the category of film editing, a category that, for the most part, lines up pretty closely with Best Picture. And yet, we have a couple of major film editors who did not make it into this cut, even though their film is in the Best Picture race. So, let's see where we go. Film editing, Ford versus Ferrari, The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Joker, and Parasite.
See, this is where it gets interesting, because Parasite, if it wins Best Picture, it would make sense that it would win editing. Now, okay, all right, question. Editing has nothing to do with the actual visual effects, to clarify that. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Here's why I asked that question.
Yeah.
Because Irishman, I don't think, has great visual effects. I don't think the CG is incredible. But the editing of that film is extremely well done. So I wonder if that plays into it. I mean, it's funny because I feel like, I don't know, where are you guys going on this? I'm going to go Irishman.
I'm going to say Ford versus Ferrari.
I'm going to say Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, all right. Interesting.
All right, I like that. Okay.
I'm going to say Jojo Rabbit.
No one said Parasite.
No. You know what?
It's probably the one that's going to win, but it's fine.
God. All right. International feature film. We all say Parasite?
Yeah.
All right. Let's skip to the next one. Documentary feature. All right. This is going to be a problem. I haven't seen these.
There's a very clear answer.
American Factory, The Cave, The Edge of Democracy, For Sama, and Honeyland. There's an obvious answer here?
Yeah.
I'm going to say American Factory because it's President Obama.
There you go. American Factory.
Well, all right. I'll say that too, then. I really don't know.
We probably should have sent these to Gabe before we did this, but it's fine. I actually like it this way.
I like figuring it out in the moment.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. All right.
All right. Cinematography. Irishman, Joker, Lighthouse, 1917, and Hollywood.
You don't like me, Lobster?
Please pick Lighthouse. Please.
Oh, God.
I'm going with Deakins again.
Deakins, yeah. Baby. Deakins.
Deakins.
Over Richardson, huh?
Well, it should be Richardson, but Deakins is going to win it, yes.
Oscar Richardson III? Yeah. I love that nickname so much. All right, we all say 1917. Boy, that's a lot of wins for 1917 so far. All right.
Will this be a Mad Max situation if it doesn't win Best Picture? They want all that tech stuff?
Well, we'll discuss. We have some serious things to discuss with the director picture breakdown. So we'll get there.
Original screenplay. By the way, I'm super excited about, because we don't know what's going to win. It's just really kind of cool, but continue.
What do you mean we don't know? You swear up and down it's 1917.
Well, yeah, I know, but I'm saying like Parasite's creeping in there. So, but we'll get to that.
It is.
Go ahead.
I'm going to watch Parasite again this weekend because Michelle hasn't seen it yet. And she's keeps asking me, like, should I see this film? And I said, yeah, absolutely, you should watch it. But there's a couple things she doesn't. So I think we're going to watch it on Saturday. Not that anyone cares. Does anyone care that I'm going to watch it on Saturday?
Thanks, sure. I do. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, original screenplay. Knives Out, Marriage Story, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Parasite. Original screenplay. Jakey.
I'm sorry. I don't think it's going to our boy. I think it's going to Parasite.
It is.
I'm going with Quentin.
I hope you're right. I really hope you're right.
Yeah. Why are you guys turning on this all of a sudden?
Oh, no. There's no turning.
I feel like
again, not heart. I'm not saying
no. I feel like Parasite has just got the wind behind it right now, and I feel like and I know that Quentin didn't compete for the Writers Guild, but if anything, that just means, but Parasite won the Writers Guild in the original screenplay category, and so that means it's on everyone's radar. I feel like Parasite just sort of has everyone's attention right now.
I'm going to be completely transparent here, which I am always honest, but this is a very interesting category because I feel like Parasite is going to win, but I can't predict it. I just can't do that to Quentin Tarantino. I can't. I want to put this out in the universe that he's gonna win. I have no idea what's gonna happen. But Parasite, Jake is definitely leaning towards where that award is probably gonna go. But I'm gonna, you know, Quentin clearly deserves it over.
Good for you for following your heart. I hope you remember that whenever you have to watch whatever horrible movie I'm gonna put in front of your eyes.
If I lose by one and it's because of that, I'll take it. It's fine.
And here's why I'll say this, because as we get into these other categories, I'm really afraid Quentin's not going to win. And I think a lot of people will be willing to give him screenplay if they go a different direction.
But you're assuming that people vote in the big picture.
Oh, I think they do.
You think they do?
I think more people do than not. Yes. Especially when you hear those anonymous ballot stories, which are really frustrating, to be honest.
Yeah, I hate those. Those are why do we still do those?
But when you hear the rationale given by a lot of people, you're like, God, I never would have even thought that. Are you kidding me? But that's where people come across with when they have cast their ballot. So
I honestly, at the moment right now, I do actually think Quentin Tarantino is going to win, but I am very afraid of Parasite sneaking in there and grabbing that from Quentin Tarantino.
Look, I would rather be wrong and you guys get a point over me then be right and get and Quentin not win. So I'm gonna say Parasite, but I hope I'm wrong.
All right, let's move to adapted screenplay. It's kind of interesting too. We have The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Joker, Little Women, and The Two Popes. I'm gonna say Little Women takes this one.
I'm gonna say Taika and Jojo take it.
I agree. Interesting.
It's going to be Jojo Rabbit.
Did they win Writers Guild?
They did.
Interesting. No. I
don't Little Women's come back now, O'Connell.
No, I'm not. I'm still saying Little Women. But I was just curious. That's intriguing. It's so funny. Like, there are a couple of these movies that make me feel like, we gave score to Joker. But I'm trying to think of what else we gave. Like, are some of these movies going to get a bunch of nominations but not win anything? Like, what would Jojo win? What would Little Women win? You know, is Irishman actually going to get shut out, basically, out of every category?
Irishman's going 0 for 10.
That's crazy to me. Yeah. All right.
And that will be the second time Scorsese's had a movie go 0 for 10.
I did actually have a thought today at work about predicting The Irishman to win Best Picture, just because it would be so bat-ass insane if that happened. Like, you know what I mean? I don't know. But
all right, Gabe wants me to point out that right now, Kevin and Jake only have two categories that are different picks from one another. So there's a very good chance you two may tie and I have to watch something horrible because I went out on a limb for poor Greta Gerwig. Animated feature, How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, I Lost My Body, Klaus, Missing Link, and Toy Story 4.
I'm going to go Missing Link.
I feel like this is a tougher one than people are giving it credit for. I'm going to say Toy Story 4, but I wouldn't be surprised if I'm wrong. I could see it going to Missing Link. I could see it going to Klaus. But I'm going to say Toy Story 4. Because I feel like, talking about the average Oscar viewer, I feel like they're just going to say, Pixar, Toy Story 4.
I'm going to say I Lost My Body.
Oh, I'm going to say Missing Link.
Okay, there you go. All three of us, different picks.
Wait, didn't Missing Link win the Golden Globe?
I mean, yeah, but...
That's the only reason why I'm going with that. I haven't seen this coming. So
okay, here we go.
Gabe, are you happy? We're different now.
Best Director. Martin Scorsese. Todd Phillips. Sam Mendes. Sorry,
dude. He's been on the show.
Friend of the show, Quentin Tarantino. And Bong Joon-ho. For Parasite. All right.
Go ahead, Kevin. Pick Quentin. Go ahead. Stick to your heart. Go ahead.
Well, there's no heart here. We know Mendes is going to win this, right? I'm going Sam Mendes.
I don't know, man.
I understand.
How quickly you abandon your morals whenever it comes to the big category.
Here's the thing. At the end of the day, I still actually think Quentin's going to win screenplay, but your Parasite pick is actually something that I've been thinking about a lot, and that's coming up. So that they're neck and neck, but I went with Quentin because that's who I've been thinking about all along in regards to that category. This category is Mendes.
I'm going to have to agree with him.
Yeah, I think it's Mendes. I think it's Mendes's to lose.
And again, I'm fine with that. I don't know why I feel bad. Picking him, Kevin, it's a remarkable achievement.
it's a remarkable technical achievement.
He's the director!
He directed it!
See, this is where we get into our argument about what a director does. Directors tell a story and have to get emotions out of the audience.
But they have to put the story onto film!
I get that, but Sam's not shooting the movie. Roger Deakins is the star of that film, not Sam Mendes.
He had to tell Deakins didn't even want to do it that way.
That's fine. My point being is that Sam Mendes is a storyteller, and I think he's a very, very good director. I freaking love Road to Perdition and American Beauty, but the director award for that movie, that's not a director's movie. I'm sorry. It's not.
You're the first person to say, whenever we were talking about sort of the one shot, you're the first person to say, well, Hitchcock already did it for Rope. So you don't say the cinematographer did it for Rope. You say Hitchcock did it for Rope.
Well, first of all,
The cinematographer of Rope, by the way?
I have no idea the cinematographer of Rope.
That's your point.
Dude,
you're missing the point. Back in the day, Hitchcock, it was all his decision process in regards to those 10-minute film mags.
Decision.
I'm just saying, I do not. Also, Rope is a much more emotional film than 1917.
No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about something he crafted.
Okay. So
I don't think so. I think Rope is just as much about the gimmick as you claim 1917.
I disagree. Dude, 1917.
Just because you like the story better doesn't mean that.
Hitchcock did not come out with a 4-minute featurette that played in movie theaters explaining how he did his movie.
You can't do that. That's a different world, man.
Come on. 1917
I hope we're not. I hope we're not hurting you by poking holes in your argument.
What's funny about this conversation, and I can't wait to have this a year later, neither of you actually care about 1917's characters.
No, I do.
My number three of the year.
No, you do not. There's no way that you think about
it. It was my number three of the year.
You can't tell us
we don't care about a movie.
No, I do not think you genuinely cared about those characters. I think you were blown away by the technical achievement. I think the story grabbed you.
You can't do that.
That's my opinion.
But you're letting your opinion of the movie sway how we feel about a movie.
No.
If I told you that I didn't think you actually genuinely care about the characters of Jay and Silent Bob reboot because I don't care about the characters like that. I mean, how would you respond to that?
It's the same thing you do to me when you tell me that I'm disliking a film because it's gaining traction at the Oscars. That yes, you did.
I never tell you that. I admitted to me doing that sometimes.
You said that I was not liking 1917 or Parasite because they were gaining traction and popularity to win Best Picture. You said that. I remember you saying it to me. And I was like, that's not true. It has nothing to do with the popularity of a film. I mean, it's the same thing that I'm saying back to you. I just don't agree that 1917 was an emotional film that worked.
I thought it was
technically cool. That's right. I don't think Mendes deserves best director.
I think your argument's leaking because of all the holes we're poking in it.
There's no holes in it, man.
There are holes. There are holes the size of us plot holes. That's how big the holes are. The holes are.
Jake, tell me the two leading characters' names in 1917.
Dude, you know how many movies I barely remember your three names at the end of this podcast every week.
Tell me the two leading
characters. You know how many people I come across on whose names are... Dude, that means nothing. That means absolutely nothing.
George and Frank.
That's ridiculous. No, Jake didn't know that, though.
That means nothing.
It does mean something. It means nothing.
I also think I think I'm wrong. I think one of them might be George, but the other one's definitely not Frank.
One of them's Schofield. That's all I remember.
Oh, right. Yes,
that means absolutely nothing.
Okay, hold on. I would like to honor the two directors of photography that Hitchcock needed to pull off Rope, by the way. Their names are William Scull and Joseph Valentine. Yeah. So you learned something in today's episode.
The difference between Rope... and 1917 is that Rope actually has a great story with great performances that is memorable and that it rises above the technical achievement.
But you call it Alfred Hitchcock's Rope.
Rope. Dude, 1917 is Roger Deakins' movie, not Sam Mendes' film.
That makes no sense. That.
I don't understand how you do that.
It makes perfect sense.
You can't say that.
You are missing the point. All right, I'm going to say this one more time and then we'll move on. 1917... is a technical achievement, and I do not think it was well directed. I think it was well shot and well executed in that standpoint. A director, in my opinion, tells a great story that captures its audience and gives you memorable characters that you actually care about journey.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So whoever is credited with directing Irreversible is not a director? Because you don't like the story or the characters.
I turned off Irreversible. I've never finished it. How can I tell you what the movie, if I liked it or not?
But why does the story and the character have to matter whether they qualify as a director or not?
Because story is the most important job of a director. Any director will tell you that. And you guys can, Steven Spielberg will tell you that story is more important.
I don't disagree with that.
Okay,
no, I don't.
So nothing in my opinion in 1917, for me personally, did not grab me and wasn't memorable story-wise.
But that doesn't mean you can strip away his title of director. He didn't direct the movie.
So, right. Kevin, let's say as a reporter, I pull off a live shot from space where I plummet down to the earth, but it's a fairly long and boring live shot. Are you going to say that I'm not, aside from the fact that I pulled off a live shot going from space down to earth, are you going to say I'm not a reporter because it was boring?
No, we're talking about two different things.
If you don't care, that it takes away from the fact that he pulled off an astonishing achievement.
I would tell you that live shot had a great technical achievement, but did not have a good storytelling tool, which is the director's fault.
Excellent. All right, fine. We're never going to settle this. We all made our picks. Let's move on to supporting actress. Whew. All right. Kathy Bates for Richard Jewell. Laura Dern for Marriage Story. Scarlett Johansson for Jojo Rabbit. Florence Pugh for Little Women and Margot Robbie for Bombshell. I'm saying Laura Dern.
I think I think we're about to hit four in a row that we all agree on. I think it's going to be Laura Dern.
Laura Dern. Yeah,
you agree. This is frustrating in the sense that I think all of these actor categories are locked up. So let's go to supporting actor. You have Tom Hanks for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Anthony Hopkins for The Two Popes. Oh, Two Popes is another one that has a bunch of nominations and doesn't feel like it's going to win anything, unfortunately, because I think it's a charming movie.
But I also feel like it got a lot more nominations than it expected to. So I think for them, the nominations are the win.
Probably. Al Pacino for The Irishman, Joe Pesci for The Irishman, and what I would assume is our choice for winner, Brad Pitt for OU812. Correct?
Yep. The real winner is, does Pesci show up?
Oh, no. No? Absolutely not. Lead actress, Cynthia Erivo for Harriet, Scarlett Johansson for Marriage Story, Saoirse Ronan for Little Women, Charlize Theron for Bombshell, and Renee Zellweger for Judy. Now, if any of the four acting categories have a potential for an upset, I kind of feel like it's here. And it happens every once in a while, right? Somebody picks up all of them along the way, and then you get to one who doesn't win. And while I think that Renee Zellweger has picked up everything up until this point, I think there's a potential for her to be upset by someone like Charlize Theron for Bombshell. But I don't think that enough to not pick Renee Zellweger for Judy. I will say Judy on the record.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Renee. I think this is actually one of the more boring categories. If there were going to be an upset, I'd be okay with it being this cat. I just really didn't like that movie. I thought she was good in it. I didn't, but I just how much like I just thought that movie was kind of boring.
Kev, do you think she wins it?
Oh yeah, that's the acting categories are locked.
But what bothers me about that then is that means that we saw a performance in September that, according to everybody else, has not been topped since. And I don't think that's the case. Like, I think she was really good in Judy, and I can understand why she'd be an Oscar winner. But, like, Charlize Theron blew me away. Saoirse Ronan was tremendous in Little Women. And Scarlett Johansson was off the charts great in Marriage Story. And I don't 100% understand why we've all fallen in line and just saying that Judy Garland is the role for Renee Zellweger to win. Her second,
and I like Renee,
Oscar.
But like also her award season run hasn't been particularly exciting. Like none of her speeches have been, oh my God, head over heels charming, or like, oh my God, I can't wait to see what she's going to say next. Or like nothing about that category has excited me.
Pitt and Joaquin are both doing that. They've been terrific at all of these award ceremonies and are escalating their speech game. And so you hope that, you know, that continues at the Oscars. So that brings us.
Was wondering something today, and this is something I think is interesting. If you're an actor who's winning all these awards and all these leading up to the Oscars, you've given, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 speeches by this point.
Sure.
At what point in the Oscar season do you start adjusting which speech is going to have what? So does Joaquin, okay, if he thinks he's going to win the Oscar, does he save things and not say them at SAG and not say them at Globes, or same with Pitt? because Pitt's been like on fire.
Okay, but to your point, let me ask you something. Is that Brad Pitt writing all those jokes for his award speeches?
No, I don't think so.
I think that's off the top of his head.
No, I don't think. Because like, I feel like he's never been this style or this level of funny before in his entire life. And I just feel like every one of these speeches feels like it was written by a professional comedy writer. I genuinely feel. Now, Joaquin, I think that's 100% organic. I think that's all coming from him. But all of these like one-liners, even the ones that Margot Robbie read at the BAFTAs, like they all sound like they are coming from like an SNL writer. Like to me, they don't sound like they're coming from Brad.
I think that everything Brad Pitt is saying on stage is off the top of his head. I don't think he's planning anything. I think he's genuinely just that funny. Because we've never seen the guy accept awards before like this, right? I mean, we've never seen him. I mean, if we had other award categories to compare it to, I just think he's going up there and riffing. I really do. I think the guy is just, I don't know. I mean, again, we've all spent time with him in regards to interviews and, when I see him on stage doing that, that's the guy that I was interviewing for Ad Astra. He's just a laid back, chill dude who's just hilarious.
I'll say this.
Yeah.
If I were about to win a major award like that, I'd be hiring somebody to write something cool for me. I know when Chris Rock was hosting, he talked in an interview about he would tap all of his friends from the Comedy Zone, the Comedy Store in LA for like weekends. They'd come to his house and just riff material at him. Now he's a host, you know, and you would assume Chris Rock is funny enough to write his own material to do the thing, but he just in that moment needed as much input as physically possible.
Well, they all do that. Every person that's ever hosted, yeah. They have a team of writers. Like you're sure. Like whether they're funny or not, whether you're Billy Crystal or Chris Rock or Steve Martin or whatever the case may be, like they all have it. Like there's no shame in it. I just don't feel like as great as those Brad Pitt speeches are, I just don't think that I don't think that they're him.
Who do you think wrote Glenn Close's speech?
Oh. You guys remember that year that Eddie Redmayne won, and the shot of Eddie Redmayne walking up to the stage to accept his Oscar, you could see Michael Keaton putting his speech back in his pocket.
Oh, that hurts.
Yeah,
he came so Glenn Close that year.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
It was so stupid. He's also terrible. First in line to see Birds of Prey Men this weekend. Sam Mendes shouldn't win. Thank you.
All right. Lead actor. I think we know it's going to be Joaquin Phoenix, right? Antonio Banderas for Pain and Glory. Leonardo DiCaprio for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Adam Driver for Marriage Story. Joaquin Phoenix for Joker. Jonathan Pryce for Two Popes. We all say Joaquin, right?
Can I say something about Joaquin Phoenix for a second? This is something that I have problems with in regards to the way film society is nowadays. Everything's comparable. Everyone wants to compare this and that. Everyone's like, oh, who's the best Joker of all time? And now they're pitting him up against Heath Ledger. You know, these are stories that are actually coming out in articles of like, who's the best Joker ever? And then you have these two next to each other. Can't we just have a different person playing same characters and not have to compare them?
We do that with Batman. Like you have a favorite Batman.
No. My point being is that Ledger, I think it's different with Ledger. Since Ledger's passed away, I just feel like it's just not really, I think it's more of a clickbaity thing when you're putting Ledger's name like that.
That's just what we do.
I know, but I don't know. I've just not liked the way I've felt seeing articles like that. That's all.
Well, it's interesting too. Also, like once the movie screened, the question from most people I got was, how is it compared to Heath? And my answer was, it's like they both tried something totally different. It's almost not fair to compare it from that perspective. In that they're not trying to do the same thing, but
they're completely
different.
I think it's fair to not have an answer, but I also think it's fair to ask the question.
I
don't think it's fair to say, oh, you can do it with Batman, but you can't do it with Joker.
You know what I did hate though? When he went backstage at the Globes and one of the first questions to him was like, what did you do to prepare for that's exhausting.
Yeah.
You know, when you're just, and he said legitimately, like, haven't I answered this question like 1,000 times over the past few months? Like that gets really obnoxious to me. And that's my own people. I hate to say, come on, my colleagues do better than that. That's why the three of us would never do that. We would never lead off with, how did you prepare for this?
What attracted you to the role?
And by the way, if you want to listen to how we did interview Joaquin Phoenix, you can go back to episode number so-and-so and find our interview with Joaquin Phoenix for the Joker. So, I don't know. Gabe, what number was that? 80-something? 90? Gabe, produce, for God's sakes. Best picture. Whew, this could be the tiebreaker right here. Joker. It was what? What?
86.
Six. Episode number 86. Joaquin Phoenix. 35 minutes. And dare I say, he had fun. Best picture. Joker, 1917. Ford v. Ferrari. Little Women. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Parasite. The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, and Marriage Story. I am going to say that Best Picture, after picking Sam Mendes for director, is going to go to 1917 from the Academy that brought you Green Book last year. Everybody likes to get very... The Oscars are going to go out on a limb. Yeah, they're going to honor... No, they're not. They're not. They're not going to honor Parasite. They're not going to honor Joker. They're going to honor 1917, the most Academy movie to hit the circuit this season.
Yeah.
Kevin?
No question. 1917 won the Oscar for Best Picture back in like November of last year when people started seeing it. It is... Oh. The perfect Oscar film. It screams Oscars. It is nothing in that movie moves cinema forward. And to me, a Best Picture should be something that moves cinema forward. It should be something that's changed cinema, changed the way, you know, you look back on many, many of these years, the movies they've chosen, no one's talking about them anymore. King's Speech, The Artist, films that beat out films like Inception or Social Network or Saving Private Ryan. It's such a predictable thing. And I think, yeah, there are some years where they get it right. Return of the King, I was happy with that. Shape of Water, I don't know that I think that was the best picture of the year, but I was okay with that choice because it was out of the box for them. But 1917 is just checks everything off. And it's being hailed by a lot of people as like this original idea, and it's just not. And I just think that that is just the movie that everyone is embracing. People understand the technical ideas of it because it's been kind of forced upon people via featurettes. And I think that is blowing people's minds to a point where they're being clouded to not think about the story, but they're thinking about more the technical achievement of it. So it automatically becomes Best Picture. So no question, 1917.
Jake is about to throw us a curveball.
I know he's going to say.
I think it's going to Parasite.
There you go.
I
could see it on his face. I could see that curveball coming.
I mean, SAG gave them Best Ensemble, and they are the biggest percentage of voting body.
Mm-hmm.
I think they got so much flack and were considered an embarrassment last year for Green Book that they're going to feel the need to course correct. I feel like they're not going to pass up an opportunity to make history. I feel like there's been a lot more press about Parasite being the potential first foreign language film to win a Best Picture than there ever was about Roma. Roma was that close to doing it last year, and I feel like no one was really talking about how it would make history. I feel like that conversation's a lot more out there this time around. I think these past few years, the last 10, 15 years, we've seen a lot of split between director and picture, with director going to more of a technical achievement and picture going to more of a well-rounded achievement. And I think... while Mendes is going to take 1917 to a best director victory, I think Parasite takes picture.
Well, what's interesting about that is I hope that happens. I mean, I would much rather see Parasite win over 1917. And I like Parasite. I didn't love Parasite. But Parasite winning would be like Shape of Water for me. Like it's out of the box. It's a different type of film. Even though I think it's, you know, I think Us did it better in regards to thematics. But I do think that Parasite winning would make me way happier than 1917.
All right, I don't want to disrupt this conversation with facts, but we like to lean into the fact that, like, oh, SAG is the biggest body. 2 years ago, they gave it to Three Billboards, and that movie lost. Last year, they gave it to Black Panther. That movie lost also. So we shall see if the Screen Actors Guild Awards helps Parasite at all. But I feel like the Academy is always very comfortable to just be like, you win the best foreign language movie. You know, go ahead, get out of here.
1917 is the safest film out of all nine of them. It's the safe Oscar film.
Ford Ferrari is the safest Oscar film.
Which one?
Ford Ferrari.
Yeah, but that's not even in the contention. Like, okay, we're talking about the actual people who are like really, really in contention.
But it's a Best Picture nominee. In contention.
No, I know, but the ones that are really going at each other, Hollywood, Parasite, 1917, and I guess you could put Marriage Story in there if you want to as it trickles behind. But 1917 is clearly the safe choice.
But also, keep on, like, the preferential ballot is also what makes this so tough, because the preferential ballot takes all the reasoning and statistics that we right. have and shakes them up and just throws that out there and goes, okay, here you go. So all reasoning and statistics go out the window because of the preferential ballot.
All right, so those are our picks for what we think is going to win Sunday night at the Oscars. Be sure to track our progress along as you guys watch the show on Sunday. And then we're going to record on Monday to get you our reaction show as quickly as possible. Should post by Tuesday, and we'll be able to discuss everything that we learned via the Academy Awards ceremony. And we'll finally put a bow on this year's awards season, essentially. Good Lord. The marathon season that began all the way back in September when we went to TIFF and started to see some of these movies for the very first time. That brings us to This Week in Movies with something called And Then We Danced.
Wait, is this the week where Gabe inserted a fake one?
It might as well be. Wait, no, I'm going to read you the next. Has either of you seen And Then We Danced?
No.
All right. How about Waiting for Anya?
No.
No, of course not. No.
Is it because she was dancing?
Waiting for Anya. Okay, now The Lodge, I've heard good things about. Apparently, this is a horror film that's getting incredible reviews. I have not had a chance to see it yet. Have you guys seen The Lodge?
I have not.
The Lodge. All right. Well, that brings us to Birds of Prey. Jake and I have both seen Birds of Prey because we got to see it at the junket. Kevin is going to go see it after we record this week's episode. Jakey, spoiler-free review of Birds of Prey. Where are you at on it?
Very, very, very pleasantly surprised. Really just had an absolute blast with this thing. I mean, speaking as someone who genuinely hated Suicide Squad, but did feel that Margot Robbie was probably the best thing about that movie. They took the best. I mean, and here's the deal too. They're calling it a Birds of Prey movie. It's basically an R-rated Harley Quinn movie, and then the Birds of Prey kind of form.
Oh, yeah.
But I just thought, I mean, the direction, the writing, the sense of humor, the performances, the self-awareness of everything. It's DC just letting loose and having fun and going, you know what? We tried connecting all these movies. It didn't work out. Let's just focus more on making good movies and worry less about making a universe. And that has just benefited them, you know, 1,000 times over. I had an absolute blast. I think this is DC's Deadpool, essentially. And I mean that as a massive compliment. I absolutely loved this movie. And it makes me so happy to say that because I gotta cop up to something. All the trailers and everything didn't really do anything for me. I know it was very public on this podcast by saying, you know, I'm not really into it. I don't really care. I was wrong. I saw the movie, loved it. Great theatrical experience we're seeing on the big screen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right in line with you. And it's just funny, like people who saw Suicide Squad and had problems with it, the one takeaway was, oh, but Margot Robbie was so much fun as Harley Quinn, and we'd love to see her, you know, in more of stuff. That's exactly what they did. They're giving you what you asked for coming out of Suicide Squad. She's in a new movie. They're properly using her, I think, to launch the Birds of Prey. But Jake's right. They don't get as much screen time or attention, the Birds of Prey characters, as Margot Robbie does as Harley Quinn. I got to single out, and I hate doing it. I hate in the Birds of Prey movie that has some great performances by fantastic female actors that Ewan McGregor unfortunately steals the show. Like, he's playing Black Mask and he is just completely gonzo off script. Like, you'd never know what you're going to get from him in any scene. And he's one of the most charismatic, fun, unpredictable DC villains that we've seen on screen in a very long time. In a movie like this, I think he's having a really good time. I love that it leans into the R rating also. The Deadpool comparison is definitely accurate because Harley will also break the fourth wall. It's just, once you see the jokes that are in this movie, it doesn't take itself seriously at all. There's a great bit about a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich that is hilarious. And it happens pretty early on. And I was like, oh, this movie kind of gets it. You know, it's just going to be a fun time, a crowd pleaser that I think everybody's really going to dial into. And like Jake said, I think it's when it's freed from having to carry plot lines that will be continued in other movies that you can just, like it's liberating to go to a superhero movie that begins and ends and that's it. It doesn't have to keep adding to the larger narrative. And I didn't realize how much I missed that until I saw it in Birds of Prey. So go see it.
Sean, in the movie, do they ever break down like Harley Quinn's favorite actors and like movies? Like, do they go into that kind of stuff with her?
Let me see. Do they ever do Harley's?
Well,
actors. No.
The reason why I'm asking that question is because Harley Quinn is famous for loving the movie Crocodile Dundee 2. And I was just curious if you knew Harley Quinn's favorite actor who appeared in Crocodile Dundee 2, the 1988 classic comedy.
Well, that's Paul Hogan. I don't know who else would. No, I don't. Is it Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman?
No, there was a famous comedian cameo in that film. Harley Colin Quinn was actually, he had a big appearance in that film. I don't know if you remember that. But
oh, my God.
Crocodile Dundee 2, 1988.
He did show Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
And Margot's an Aussie. Yeah. Nice job, Kevin.
I know,
good
that's
job,
what I'm saying.
Man. Way to bring it full circle.
Harley Colin Quinn, I told you that, yeah.
Kevin will give us his opinion of Birds of Prey on next week's episode. He's going to go see it right now. That brings us to this week's blend game, a complicated one as we start to play a new game here on the show where we're going to do underrated titles from the decades that we just recently celebrated. And the reason is, first off, we're trying to define what underrated actually means. And with all of these movies that are so good from these decades, it's tough to pick out something that isn't really celebrated overall. So in giving our picks, we have to basically explain why we think it's underrated as well, too. Gabe did not give me an order. I like to point that out every time that he misses an opportunity to help the show. So I'm going to go with Kevin first. Kevin, what's your underrated #underrated 70s blend pick.
So mine, again, I think the whole purpose of this game is the personal connection to these things, right? So this was a film that I had never seen before prior to meeting my father-in-law, Mr. V, Damien. And he has such an incredible knowledge. I remember like when I first met my wife's dad, Lauren's dad, for the first time, I went over to his house and he tested me on my movie knowledge. Like he put Inception on and made me look for things and made me find a Brad Pitt cameo in some 80s movie that I'd never heard of before. So then Grindhouse was a big movie that came up in conversation with us, and Death Proof specifically. And there was a movie that Quentin Tarantino essentially, you know, modeled that film after. It was a huge homage, which was Vanishing Point, 1971. And it's, as I watched it, and I've heard my father-in-law, Mr. V, talk about this movie so many times over the years and all the different trivia. He's a big fan of going on IMDb and reading all the trivia for all the different movies. So much so that I kind of know it all at the top of my head, like everything about the different details of that film. This is a movie that came out in 1971. Essentially, the character Kowalski is driving a car, I believe, from Colorado to San Diego, I want to say, and he has to deliver it on a certain day. And it was like a 1970 Dodge Challenger was the car. And I remember my father-in-law would always say they had 8 cars that were on set. And then one of them remained at the end because they crashed them all. And then one of the things he always brings up is on the DVD of that film, Charlotte Rampling actually had a part in that film that was taken out of the U.S. release. So the DVD apparently has the U.S. and the U.K. and they kept her part in the U.K. release, which is like apparently a famous thing for that film. I love that movie because I just love the practicality of the action and the driving and the just that road trip type story where he's being chased. And you know, this is a movie that has heavily influenced a lot. I was actually reading about a lot of this today, and I did not know how heavily this movie influenced things. There was an Audio Slave video called Show Me How to Live, which is a great song. That video was apparently an entire homage to Vanishing Point. They intercut it with the movie. There's albums and music that have been inspired by that film. Quentin Tarantino used the same license plate in Death Proof, which is OA5599. Which is, I think, the license plate of Kowalski's character and also the license plate of Kurt. I'm blanking on his name at the moment. But yeah, you're thinking about the influence this movie had and Kurt Russell's character.
I'll say Baby Driver too.
Baby Driver. Yeah. Both Quentin Tarantino and Edgar Wright have mentioned that film was one of their favorite movies they've ever seen. And I never even heard of it until I met my father-in-law. So it just has a special place in my heart. Why is it underrated? Because it cost, I think, $1.3 million to make it. It made $12 million at the box office. And I guess for me, it's underrated because I'd never heard of it. Not that that's a barometer for something being underrated or not, but I just had never seen it or heard of it. And it was because of my father-in-law that I discovered it. And then I learned about Quentin Tarantino's love for it. And so that's why that's my underrated pick.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's exactly the qualifications of it. If it's not a movie that gets discussed all that often, but filmmakers tend to reference it as something that that's... A touch point for them.
Have you guys seen it?
Oh, yeah. I've not seen it. No, I've never seen it.
Awesome. It is awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome movie. Like genuinely awesome. If you haven't seen it, check it out.
I hope people, use this conversation to point out titles that they haven't yet seen before. Jakey, you're up.
Okay, here's the deal. I'm going to name a movie and you guys are going to go, oh, but people love that movie. But I have a justifiable reason why I think it is actually underrated. All right. My 70s pick for underrated film is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And the reason I think that that's an underrated film is because people don't give it enough credit for changing the way a lot of things about the genre worked and creating a lot of aspects that we talk about with other horror films, but not the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The first one being viral marketing. These days, remember how big of a deal it was when the writer and directors of the Blair Witch Project did this huge, big, giant viral campaign convincing the world that this was an actual tape that people found out in the woods and that we were just going to see it in the big screen. And it was this huge thing. Toby Hooper was the first person to do that. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is not a true story. It's not even close to a true story. It's based on a guy who killed people and maimed them in Wisconsin. The same guy that inspired movies like Psycho and Silence of the Lambs.
Ed Gein, right?
Yes, Ed Gein.
Yeah.
But he convinced the world for a large, large, large period of time that this was based on a true story. And that was a huge part of its viral market. It was before things went viral. It was a huge part of its viral campaign. Also, it created this world of do-it-yourself filmmaking in the horror genre in a decade in which horror writers and directors were doing the complete opposite. When you look at the biggest horror films of that decade, you're looking at Jaws, The Exorcist, Halloween, The Omen, Alien. These are high profile, big budget, big studio, big director, oftentimes big star horror films. And then you've got this guy in Texas spending 30 grand with him and his friends making this ugly, grungy, let's just do it ourselves kind of do it. And there are a lot of filmmakers out there who saw what Toby Hooper was doing and went, oh, like, maybe I can do that. Because you don't look at Alien or The Exorcist or Jaws and think, I can do that. Like, that doesn't make you pick up an 8mm film and run into your backyard and start making a horror movie. But you see something like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that makes you go, well, shit. Like, if he can do that with all of his friends and make all of these weird props with bones and antlers and just kind of run around with a camera, then make the movie that he made, then I can do that too. So yes, it's a beloved film, and I think, you know, I think a lot of people would say, like, oh, it's a good horror movie. I'm not discounting the fact that people like it as a horror film, but they're discounting really what it did for the genre. Because when people talk about the most influential horror films of all time, I feel like no one ever really talks about The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the impact that it had, not just on the genre, but on the filmmakers that would grow up believing that they could do it because Toby Hooper did.
And also, Jake, like one thing that it's interesting about that film is, like, you, and I'm sure you know this information, but Toby Hooper is a huge Keanu Reeves fan. And I was just curious if you knew Toby Hooper's favorite Keanu Reeves film, because this is super interesting.
Hold on.
Did you even hear anything that I said, by the way, or were you just waiting on me to stop talking so you could do this?
2 seconds. One, if you go back and listen to the audio, I said 3 times it was a good pick, and I actually agree. I think that film is an underrated. I think it's a good pick. I actually said that a couple times.
Every time you
I think most of us just assume that that's what Texas is. Isn't Texas just like that?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it felt like a documentary to me.
You know what? Well, that was good. Texas is the greatest country in the world, and you just lost your passport, sir.
Fine. Go back to guessing Kevin's pun.
So back to Toby Hooper's favorite Keanu Reeves film. Any guesses on this, Sean?
No, none here. You're on an island.
Texas Chain Reaction Saw Massacre.
God, get out of here, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was
my God.
Remember Chain Reaction? Remember that movie?
No.
Remember Chain Reaction?
No one remembers Chain
Reaction. Dude, it was a big movie in the 90s, wasn't it?
Morgan Freeman? Morgan Freeman's in that?
Yeah, let me see who Chain Reaction. That was definitely... What if that
was? Oh, wait, snowmobiles? It was snowmobiles? Is that what Gabe was doing? No? All right, never mind. All right, my pick. I'm going to go with a movie that I guarantee you guys have not seen. John Frankenheimer's 1977 film, Black Sunday. Black Sunday is the prototype film that led into the Die Hards of the world. And it's really funny. It's like that came first, Die Hard came later, and then Die Hard ended up inspiring a million different movies, which is... there is a terrorist plot that's going to place a bomb at the Super Bowl in the 1970s. And the cast, Robert Shaw being one of them.
There's a bomb at the bowl.
Has to stop it from taking place. But the set piece, now it's a pretty good movie leading up to this point. And the director is John Frankenheimer, who I don't think gets enough. This feeds into the undervalued pick. John Frankenheimer is trying to establish himself in a decade of directors that's essentially... Coppola, Scorsese, De Palma, Spielberg, William Friedkin, Robert Altman, Sidney Lumet, Hal Ashby. Frankenheimer's over here making The Manchurian Candidate. He's doing The Iceman Cometh. He does French Connection 2, and then he leads into Black Sunday. And when you go back and watch Black Sunday, okay, fine. It moves pretty slow for most of its time. It's, you know, investigators trying to track down... a terrorist group that's going to be responsible for placing this bomb at the Super Bowl. But the final set piece is worth the time alone in that the terrorists take over the Goodyear blimp. They fly the Goodyear blimp over the stadium where the Super Bowl is taking place, and they plunge it down towards the 50-yard line. And the heroes, in an effort to stop them, have to take over a news helicopter, chase after the Goodyear blimp, and using practical effects, they swing one of the detectives down from the helicopter to land on top of the Goodyear blimp. Like, they legitimately had stuntmen doing this. And then a mix of really bad green screen and up-close shots that are clearly nowhere near a blimp or a football game. But just the thinking outside the box to coming up with a really big set piece, you know, to end your tentpole action thriller on... Black Sunday gets credit for being, I think, the godfather to a lot of movies that we loved in the 80s and 90s, and Frankenheimer shoots the hell out of it and edits it really, really well. So I'm going to single that out. It's, who else is in that besides? It's Robert Shaw and one other big-time actor whose name is escaping me. Shoot, now I got to go to the IMDb because it's a pretty big guy.
Did Robert Shaw do that right after Jaws?
Well, it's 1977, so yeah, it would have been right around that time. Oh, you know who else? It's based on a book by Thomas Harris, who wrote Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
And Bruce Dern is the other guy who's in it. It's Bruce Dern and Robert Shaw.
They couldn't just drop the shark into the game? That would have been awesome.
That would have been pretty sweet.
No, but I like both of these. I like all these picks because, and Jake's reasoning for Tobe Hooper, it's an interesting thing because you don't, I never thought about that movie being so influential on marketing.
I texted Gabe earlier today, like I did with True Detective, just to sort of go like, dude, like, this is what I'm thinking. And I asked, I was like, are the guys going to give me shit? He goes,
no.
Well, probably, but you can try.
I don't think
I saw your face whenever I said that. You sort of went like.
You could also argue Texas Chainsaw Massacre is underrated because it's not really brought up in regards to, like, nowadays, if you think ultimately about horror films, you go Friday the 13th, Elm Street. Halloween, right?
Well, especially the horror films of the 70s, because you've got Jaws, Alien, Halloween, The Exorcist, The Omen. Right. Like, you know, it's you'd probably have to go pretty far down on the list before you bring up Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Technically,
that being
speaking,
said, we did say whenever we were when we initiated this segment last week that not just the movie do you have to justify, but why, like, your definition of the word underrated. And as we jump from decade to decade, that's why I'm actually really excited about this series of blend games that we're doing, because our definition of the word underrated could change for movie to movie, decade to decade, which is why I think it's really interesting.
Right, and technically speaking, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is an underrated film of the 70s. Like, if you think about it in that regard, because, like, you just mentioned all those heavy hitters, and all, to Sean's point, which is why that's why I love doing this show, because I never even thought about the idea of, like, okay, you have a director, John Frankenheimer, working within a field of all these masterminds and just not getting the credit he deserves because he is overshadowed. And you can say the same thing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. While it was a classic horror film, it is completely overshadowed in the decade to a point where I actually forgot it even came out in the 70s.
But and the industry needs a bunch of these guys who are just grindhouse. You know, like,
right.
You know who John Frankenheimer would have been? Tony Scott.
Yep.
Yeah, you know? Cool.
Just
cool
putting
comparison.
Out great, you know, examples of a genre that you love, but then years later you look back and you're like, oh damn, Tony Scott was really good.
Who's that guy? Who's that guy or girl? Filmmaker wise, now that is not getting his or her due because of being overshadowed by the Nolans or the Tarantinos.
I got one.
Who?
Chris McQuarrie.
Yeah, good answer.
Chris McQuarrie.
Good answer.
That's an interesting. McQuarrie's an interesting one.
Great answer.
How much credit does Cruise get for all of those things?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Cruise.
I mean, but like
one.
Because we've always heard on set that Cruise is basically co-directing those movies.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was going to say I love the first Jack Reacher, and the one that Chris McQuarrie didn't make is terrible.
Yeah.
So, right, but again, it's Cruise.
This is going to be controversial. But could you argue that Denis Villeneuve is that director?
I think he's starting to elevate himself to
the level. I feel like he's getting the critical acclaim, if not just that his movies don't do particularly well. But I feel like he's pretty highly regarded within the world of film Twitter.
Oh, what about JJ?
JJ's good, but Denis... Okay, so Denis never made a bad movie. Right. But I would argue that people know his films more than they know who he is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that's true. And I wonder if... Like, while we celebrate him, most people don't know who the heck he is.
Oh, I know. Beloved Tom Hooper. Tom Hooper. There you go.
Hey.
Director of...
That's Academy Award winner Tom Hooper to you, sir.
Toby's brother. Come on.
All right. Audience picks. Clint Tomerlin says The Outfit from 1973. Kimberly Sue went with Robin Hood, saying it's a bit underrated as a Disney film. So I guess she means the animated version.
Men in Tights. That's the good one.
Dante says
Robin
Heaven
Hood and
can
Little
wait.
John walking through the forest.
Heaven Can Wait is a terrific pick, Dante. And Reed Bennett says The Phantom of the Paradise. Why do I know The Phantom of the Paradise? That sounds familiar. Like it was inspired by something.
Is that prior to the opera or after the opera?
I think
I was just curious.
I think that's the one that inspired Meatloaf's Paradise by the Dashboard Light. That's what I think it is.
Not, by the way,
too far out there. I'm really old.
Why don't we ever talk about how brilliant Meatloaf is in Fight Club? That's like one of the what a great performance.
Bitch tits? Can I say bitch tits?
No,
on
don't
the show?
Say that.
No, I'm not allowed to. All right, cut the whole Meatloaf thing then. All right, for next week, I want. Oh God, Gabe, we haven't done this yet. All right.
What?
For next week, reach out on Twitter and play along with the new blend game, hashtag Jim Carrey Blend.
Oh.
We are going to be celebrating Sonic the Hedgehog star Jim Carrey by playing hashtag, I can't believe we haven't played that yet, hashtag Jim Carrey Blend. You can let us know your pick on social
That's
media.
That's so hard because it's like, what Jim Carrey are we talking about?
No, it's just your favorite Jim Carrey movie.
That's up to you to describe, my friend. Yeah, good luck. You can use the hashtag Jim Carrey Blend on social media, or you can
best.
Email us
favorite.
Your pick,
that's
favorite, at realblend@cinemablend.com. Okay, Gabe wants me to point out that we are one review away on iTunes from 100 reviews.
Well,
two
totally
reviews.
Get it done
Hold
by
on.
January 1st.
Sorry,
totally
we're two reviews away from... No, I'm sorry. We are one star rating away from 200. We have 95 reviews. We have 199 star. Who? No one cares.
Dude, no, no, say, honestly, we don't care.
Gabe cares. This week's review comes to someone named Enfotos2. Enfotos2. Unless it's Enfoto Season 2. Who says, refreshing and fantastical. Ooh, I like that.
Ooh.
Okay. I recently discovered this podcast and am thankful that I did. I never found much value in traditional movie reviews because they rarely capture the true essence of a film, honestly or thoroughly. But then, as a loyal watcher of Fox 5 DC, I got to experience movie reviews flipped completely upside down and in Technicolor the minute Kevin stepped in front of the camera. This is absolutely Kevin's mom writing this.
100%. Yeah, it's my grandma.
And 10%.
She's a great writer.
through his segments, I discovered this podcast and found the Neverland of films and filmmaking. I think you guys have started a revolution, breathing life back into the actors, producers, directors, and entire cinematic multiverse. Your genuine appreciation, respect, and love of their craftsmanship, genre agnostic, is infectious and refreshing! Exclamation point. That excitement can be seen and heard in more and more of your conversations and interviews. It's kind of like a modern Blythe version of Pump Up the Volume, minus the solemnness. Wow, this is all over the place. So thank you for ditching stodgy Hollywood for the fantastical side of cinema. Whoever took the time to write that review, we cannot thank you enough. That was the nicest thing anyone has ever said to us, ever. So thank you in photos too, for calling us refreshing.
And challenge to the rest of you, try to top that.
It really was. All right, well, listeners, follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. You can drop us a review on iTunes. Again, it means a ton to us. As you can see, we will read it at the end of the review. We will be back next week early as we give you our reaction to the Academy Awards, the winners, the losers, the snubs, the big surprises. And so, until we're back at it next week.
1917 wishes it was Dunkirk.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.